welcome to Wyoming Stories. I'm Micah Schweitzer. On this podcast, we bring you stories about Wyomingites in their own words. This month's episode is a little different than most because we'll be hearing from the Wyoming Public Radio news team. We've asked each of them to talk about holiday traditions or memories that stand out to them. First, we turn to Wyoming Public Radio's Irina Zhoroff. Her family is Jewish, but their holiday traditions still involve a tree and Santa.
Just before midnight, my mother helped dress us both in the bathroom. I wore a Santa suit with a formidable belly and white beard. My dad wore a tutu unearthed from my collection of retired ballet costumes, one of my mother's lacy red brassieres, and a tank top that ended mercifully above the spot where his beer belly began to curve out. He'd agreed to dress up easily, but only after we assured him that he wouldn't have to shave his severe mustache. I have never seen my father without his mustache. We guzzled champagne as we dressed. In Russian lore, Santa is known as Ded Moroz, or Old Man Frost. Old Man Frost is undisputedly more gallant than the American Santa, outfitted as he is in long embroidered robes like a wizard, and carrying a staff, which, now that I consider it, is also pretty wizard-like. Frost does not scurry down filthy chimneys, but rather he appears like a respectful shaman in full ruddy bloom and evident largesse to personally bestow his gifts to the children. He travels with his granddaughter, Snyegurochka, the snow maiden. Her origins are varied and murky in Russian fairy tales, but in most versions, she at some point melts. Though I wore an American Santa costume, I knew I portrayed Ded Moroz. My father played Snyegurochka. This is how New Year's has always worked at my house. On Christmas Day or the day after, when people start to put out their Christmas trees, we would scour the neighborhood for the best tree, preferably one with some good tinsel still intact, and bring it home for a second round of festivities. We decorated the tree with a mix of store-bought and homemade toys like tinfoil-wrapped walnuts. As head tree procurer and decorator, my enthusiasm bordered on the charmingly obsessive. Like the Americans, we bought presents. I was also slightly compulsive about the present wrapping, so I would volunteer to wrap everyone else's presents when I finished with my own. We'd stack the gifts under the tree, guarded by a giant wooden nutcracker, who once served as a prop in my dancing, and leave them there until midnight on New Year's Eve. I loved New Year's. I loved that it was not Christmas. I loved going to the Russian grocery store and running into all the other Russians who also loved New Year's and were stocking up for their respective banquets. I loved the big parties we hosted. I loved pulling out the boxes of cheap glass toys. I loved how happy my family seemed together on New Year's, and I loved that it was always a big deal. But somehow, over the years, the little traditions we had built up started to chip away from the holiday we had cherished. When I was a teenager, I dared to leave home one New Year's, and it was a disaster. When I went away to college, my mother bought a fake tree. In moments of inattention from the New Year's drill sergeant, yours truly, some people started opening presents before midnight. My mother, an innate nurse, sensed my despair. So the next year, she rented a Santa suit for me. When my father and I were dressed, she gave me one of her giant biohazard bags, which she uses to dispose of contaminated medical equipment, to pack the presents into. Dad and I marched out at midnight, he with champagne in hand, me with a biohazard bag full of wrapped gifts, to surprise the children. There were a few Americans at our party that year, and I remember their shock as we strolled around the tree and food-laden table, aunts reaching out to pat my dad's belly and laugh, Ded Moroz kind of drunk and smiling. I remember looking at them through the narrow slit formed by my Santa hat and beard and thinking, this is New Year's.
That was Wyoming Public Radio's Irina Zhoroff talking about her family's New Year's tradition. On a more somber note, we'll hear from Wyoming Public Radio news director Bob Beck about one Christmas that didn't feel quite like Christmas.
It was 1981, and I was a junior at Southern Illinois University in Carbondale. Earlier that year, my parents ended their 20-plus-year marriage, and my visit home after receiving that news was slightly uncomfortable. I was working at the campus NPR station and at a little country music station about 20 miles from Carbondale, and both desperately needed holiday help. Since I was still improving as a young broadcaster and was upset with the thought of spending Christmas at home without both parents, I made the decision to stay at school during the holiday break, make a ton of extra money, and get a lot of airtime, something that was really not easy to acquire. The one night nobody wanted to work was obviously Christmas Eve. So I agreed to take the shift and worked from 4 o'clock until midnight. Playing Christmas country songs was a bit unnerving, but a few versions were acceptable, so I lined up my music and decided to put a special twist on my evening. Borrowing from the NORAD tracking of Santa, I arranged to have the station news staff and other folks help me develop localized coverage. So you had the news director claiming to be at the airport with police following Santa's arrival into Heron, Illinois. It was a little hard to ignore the sound of people and of ice being dropped into glasses at the Christmas party he was attending, but it all worked out and it was fun. We even had a brief interview with Santa, telling all the kids that they needed to be in bed by 9 o'clock or they get nothing. My Santa character had had a few cocktails and actually started mentioning first names of kids that were on his no-present list because they were still up, which led to a call from a concerned parent asking me to go on the air to say that the Tommy Santa mentioned was not Tommy Nihil of Oak Street. Tommy was apparently crying. Anyway, for the most part, it was a successful evening and I returned to Carbondale. However, I noticed that I was the only person at my apartment, and then it hit me. I was alone on Christmas Eve. Being male college students, my roommates had one very small tree somebody's girlfriend gave us. I started thinking about the rest of my family, spending the evening at my grandmother's high-rise apartment in Chicago, singing carols and handing out gifts. I was mailed 2 actual gifts, a microwave from my dad, obviously trying to get a leg up in the best divorced parent sweepstakes, a sweater from my grandparents, and the rest were checks. Oh, there was the small canned ham the radio station gave me as a Christmas bonus. See, you got a bigger one if you were full-time. I had opened the presents before Christmas and realized I had nothing to open. I had to work the next day and sadly went to bed. I woke up the next day without the usual excitement of opening presents with family, seeing what was in the stocking, etc. So I simply showered and dressed and drove back to Heron, where I played a couple of religious shows and some more country music tunes until I was off at 2 o'clock. I figured I'd go somewhere for Christmas dinner. And then this suburban Chicago kid was introduced to Christmas Day in rural America. Nothing was open on Christmas Day. Well, there was one place. The Cardinal Drive-In featured hot dogs, various burgers, fries, and shakes. It was open as usual, and I drove up and got my Christmas dinner. It was a mushroom burger, a bag of onion rings, and a shake. Merry Christmas to me. I sat in my car listening to Christmas music and ate my lunch. I scored a 9 on the 10-point depressed scale. I didn't have a phone to call home, so I decided to drive home, and along the way came up with the idea to see a movie. I noticed the new movie Neighbors with John Belushi and Dan Aykroyd came out, so I decided to watch it. 3 of us were in the theater that afternoon, and we got to enjoy one of the weirdest and worst movies of the 20th century. Reports say that the actors had taken some, how do we politely say this, massive amounts of medication while making that movie. It showed. Leaving even more depressed, I drove home to open my canned ham and watch television next to my little tree. The next year, I decided to go home.
I'll be home for Christmas. You can count on me. Please have snow and mistletoe and presents on the tree.
Next up, we'll hear from Wyoming Public Radio's Chelsea Biondalillo. Her family always seems to get larger on Christmas.
My family lives in Phoenix, Arizona, where a balmy 55 degrees is expected on Christmas Day. But our traditions started in Oregon, where my sister and I were born. I was able to talk with my mother, Darlene, by phone about two of our most important traditions, fattening up the neighbors and extending our family to friends in need.
How many pounds of fudge do you make for every year for Christmas?
Probably 70 pounds.
She also makes cookies, and my stepdad bottles wine. Pretty much everyone they've ever met gets a plate.
We include all of the neighbors. Everyone that we know always get a plate of fudge cookies and a bottle of wine. You know, the mail, our mail carrier. People that we see and do business with on a regular basis are part of our Christmas extended family.
It's not just cookies, however. Holiday dinners in my family are a big deal, and my parents make sure that anyone who needs a seat has one. In high school, my sister and I could always bring over friends who were having trouble in their own homes. For example, a friend told her family she was gay, and that year she wasn't welcome at her own Christmas dinner, so she celebrated with us. As we grew older, our guests became coworkers or neighbors who might otherwise be alone. For my mother, this isn't just an act of altruism, but really symbolizes what this season is all about.
This is a time of year that it's important to connect with people and giving our family a chance to connect with lots of different people enriches everyone, I believe.
I also spoke with my little sister, Brianne, who lives in Phoenix with her two young sons. She says this tradition of generosity is an important example for her boys. She also says the full house helps, now that much of our extended family lives far away.
I think growing up in our giant family in Oregon, and then breaking off from them when we did move out of state, it's nice to be able to have a big holiday, even if it's not all of our family. It doesn't matter, because at that time it is family.
And she's right. In our house, it just wouldn't be Christmas without some new faces around the table. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Chelsea Biondalillo.
Our next piece is Wyoming Public Radio's Willow Belden. We'll hear about one of her family's traditions, which takes a lot of effort to pull off.
It's the week before Christmas. Carols are playing, boxes of ornaments are strewn around the house waiting to be unpacked, and I stand in the living room holding a pair of garden shears and scrutinizing the tree. My uncle grasps a branch and holds it to the side. "How would it look if we got rid of this one?" he asks. "Good," I reply. We lop off the limb and move on to the next branch. My uncle and I are in charge of trimming the tree in our family. And for us, trimming the tree actually means trimming the tree. By the time we're done, only about half the branches remain. You have to understand that my family is from New York City, so the trees we get are not what you'd find in, say, a national forest in Wyoming. They come from tree farms, and they're pruned heavily, which makes them so dense that you can barely distinguish one branch from another. This is a problem, because we put real candles on the tree. It's a tradition my grandparents brought back from Germany when they moved to the U.S. after World War II. Back then, it was easy to buy trees that were sparse enough to accommodate candles. But each year, it seems the trees are pruned more heavily, and as a result, we're confronted with an increasingly impenetrable blanket of branches. And so we have to trim, and trim, and trim, and trim. The process takes hours. We deliberate about each branch, and every so often there's a moment of panic when we realize we've made a mistake and cut too much. When that happens, we have to wire other limbs together to fill the gap. Sometimes we even glue a branch back into place. After the surgery is done, I dab some brown paint onto the places where the branches have been cut so they blend in with the trunk. And then, finally, we begin decorating. Red candles, glass balls, a silver star, and tinsel that's hung one strand at a time, like icicles. Days later, on Christmas Eve, the family gathers around the tree. We sip mulled wine, turn off all the electric lights in the house, and one by one, we light the candles. The result is magnificent. The entire tree shimmers as light dances off the tinsel and sparkles on the glass ornaments. The star floats elegantly on top of the tree, reflecting the warm glow of the candles. And we sit together and sing carols, always ending with Silent Night. For us, this is Christmas.
Oh,
Our final piece is by WPR's energy reporter, Stephanie Joyce. She tells us about overcoming the challenge of spending Christmas on a treeless island in Alaska.
Around the country, families spend their December nights trekking to nearby forests or tree farms to cut down big, bushy evergreens for their living rooms and pulling out Christmas decorations to adorn their branches. Houses fill up with the tangy smell of sap and the sharp bite of pine needles. Growing up in the nation's largest forest, the Tongass, in southeast Alaska, that had been my family's tradition. Driving up the icy road toward the municipal ski area, faces thrust out the window into the freezing wind, searching for the perfectly shaped tree. The sweaty back and forth of trying to get a rusty handsaw to make even a small dent in the bark, eventually slipping and sliding down the hill, dragging the tree behind us, and then spending hours trying to get it to stand up straight. Yes, hours. There is a reason none of us are engineers. The Aleutians are in Alaska, too, but they couldn't be more different than the place I grew up. There are no soft, snowy nights in the Aleutians in December. The temperatures hover on the harsh borderline between snow and rain, and the winds are usually howling along at 60 miles an hour. On top of that, the Aleutians are mostly treeless. There are a few left over from when Russia owned Alaska, small hunchback trees that have spent their entire lives fighting against the gales that got the islands their nickname as the birthplace of the winds. But cutting down an anemic old tree that somehow made it to age 200 is hardly in the Christmas spirit. It would be like hacking up Scrooge and sticking him in the living room under a layer of twinkle lights. So when I drew the Christmas shift my first year reporting in the Aleutian Islands, I resigned myself to a treeless holiday. But my colleague and roommate, Alexandra, had different ideas. When I walked into the living room one December night, I briefly thought a major earthquake had struck while I was driving home. Keep in mind that the Aleutians are part of the Ring of Fire, so that's not as far-fetched as it might sound. The entire living room was awash in books. And in the middle of the pile, Alexandra.
Yeah, it was a complete mess.
What were you doing?
I was making a Christmas book tree.
A Christmas book tree, you ask?
It is basically a conical structure made out of books where you lay out the books in rings on the floor and then you progressively stack smaller rings onto them, resulting in a Christmas tree-like shape. And then to make it really look like a Christmas tree, you can wrap it up in Christmas lights.
Being journalists, we had plenty of material to work with, from a monster copy of Crime and Punishment all the way down to The Little Prince. But if standing up a tree is hard, standing up a book tree is a serious engineering problem.
It's kind of like Jenga, but in reverse, where in Jenga, you know, you take pieces out and it causes everything to fall. When you're making a Christmas book tree, you are building up and building up, but it's not like you're dealing with uniform blocks. You're dealing with books of different, you know, sizes and shapes and weights. So it takes a lot of care and a lot of balance to get things just right.
And of course, being in the proper holiday spirit, the eggnog just might have come out. But several failed attempts and a healthy dose of whiskey later, we stood back to admire our handiwork, a mostly upright, 4-foot-tall tower of books wrapped in shining holiday lights. A critical element was missing, though. We didn't have a star for the top of the tree. Improvising, I picked up the now nearly empty bottle of Maker's Mark, plopped it on top of the Christmas book tree, and gave a cheers for holiday cheer. Traditional? Not quite. But one learns to improvise, living on a treeless island in Alaska. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Stephanie Joyce.
And that's it for this edition of Wyoming Stories. I'm Micah Schweitzer. Willow Belden produced this podcast. Anna Rader is our web editor. You can find each of the stories you heard today, and many others, online at wyomingpublicmedia.org. If you have a story you'd like to share, we'd love to hear from you. Information about recording your story is available on our website. Wyoming Stories is a production of Wyoming Public Media.